make the morning last. Just kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy.
Good morning, Reading. Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to Positively Healthy here on Saturday morning at 10 a.m. Well, don't go anywhere today. If you're driving, turn around, go home. I want you to listen to this show today. It's going to be fabulous. In the studio, we have with us as a co-host, we have Ryan Sabolo from the Record Searchlight.
Hello.
Hello, welcome. And we have Mark Beecham from the Record Searchlight. Good morning, Mark.
Hey.
Hey. Everybody's hyper today. And so, and on the line, let's just kind of go right to our guest here on the line. I want to read a little bit here about our guest, and then we're all just going to have a great conversation. So this is what we have. This is our guest. He writes on his blog, "My name is Hank Shaw. I write, I fish, I dig earth, raise plants, live for food, and kill wild animals. I drink bourbon or Budweiser with equal relish and wish I owned a farm. But most of all, I think daily about what new ways to cook and eat anything that walks, flies, swims, crawls, skitters, jumps, or grows. I'd like to welcome to the show today blogger and author, cook, hunter, forager, Hank Shaw. Hank, are you here?
I am indeed.
Oh, thank goodness. Okay, well, good morning. You know, I want to start today. I want to get a little history. You and Ryan have some things in common. And, you know, you people who just love to get out into the woods and kill your food and eat it. I want to start with, how were you raised, Hank?
I was not raised in a typical household. I grew up in suburban New Jersey in a Wall Street town where pretty much everybody, all my friends' parents were taking the train every morning to work in the financial district. And my mom was a shopkeeper, and she's originally from New England. And so I didn't really grow up in a kind of a wild environment.
Okay.
But my mom, from a very early age, taught me how to forage and fish. And I've been picking wild plants and berries and things and fishing for, you know, for supper since I could walk.
Oh, my goodness. And so what things did you find in New Jersey? What are you foraging for there?
Well, New Jersey is actually one of the great blueberry picking spots in the world.
Ah.
Not a lot of people know that. And the fishing is world class. And a lot of people do know that. It's one of the great places to fish for tuna. And so we started doing that from the get-go, and we would spend our summers on the shore, and we would dig clams and pick wild onions and blueberries and wild grapes and all kinds of things.
And then how did you start with commercial fishing? Is that how you got your start on the shores of New Jersey? Or
no, I did it briefly while I was in college. You know, a lot of people have a very sort of a star turn with commercial fishing when they're in college, and most people do it in Alaska. And I did it with a couple of friends, and in the warmer months, I would help them out on a squid boat, which is where you basically go out at night and you shine spotlights on the ocean, and the squid come up to the surface. And my job was to get into a little dinghy with an outboard motor that one side of the net was attached to, and I would zoom around the school of squid and catch them up in it's called a purse seine. So it's like a big old money bag full of squid. And then we haul the squid up on the top and sort through them and do it again. And then the winter months I would dig clams. And that would be in the back bays. And that was a lot safer, but a lot colder.
And then somewhere in there you started really becoming interested in the recipes? I mean, in cooking, not just maybe eating it right away. You started really thinking about flavors and how to mesh herbs and spices, or what happened for you?
Well, I went to graduate school in Wisconsin, and I was not on scholarship, so I needed to work several jobs. And one of those jobs, I was a line cook at an Ethiopian restaurant of all time.
Oh, interesting.
And you know, you want to talk flavors that are unusual, especially to, you know, a 21-year-old, 22-year-old kid. You got it.
Yeah.
I mean, half the stuff we use, what is this? What is this? And that sort of opened my eyes to a whole new world.
Well, I've just recently had Ethiopian food, and I can't believe the flavor explosions. I mean, that's some wonderful flavors. So from there, you learned how to cook, and you learned how to mix flavors a little bit, and then at what point did you start, then you started what, more of a writing career at that point, or?
Well, even then, I was
you
already...
You ended up putting them all together.
I mean, even as I was working as a line cook, I was a newspaper reporter.
Oh, okay.
I was part-time for a bunch of different jobs, and I was actually running semi-professionally at the time and going to graduate school, and I really wasn't sleeping much. But, yeah, I mean, my whole goal was to be a newspaper reporter, and I did that, and I ended up covering mostly politics for close to 20 years, and I just sort of jettisoned the day job last year.
Ah, okay, so...
Yeah, Hank, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was kind of working in newspapers is traditionally more of an urban, you know, concrete kind of environment. How did your peers view your foraging and your hunting and your fishing? I know. Didn't you work in some pretty big city newspapers at some point?
Yeah, that's the key. Much of my career was not with giant newspapers. Much of my career was with papers like the Reading Record Searchlight or the Stockton Record, which is my last paper, which is sort of, you know, mid-range paper. I did work for the St. Paul Pioneer Press in the Twin Cities, which is a big city paper. But when you're at a smaller paper, you're much more likely to encounter colleagues who fish or hunt or forage or something. You know, the smaller the paper, the more rural the reporters are. And the bigger papers, it was crazy. I mean, I was sort of the newsroom freak.
You know, hey,
what'd you kill this week, Hank? You know, and kill anything? Now, you know, the obvious answer is not yet.
Jay's still young.
Yeah, one of the things I really enjoy about my job is, you know, we don't really have a lot of outdoors type folks. And I really get a kick out of bringing in various critters for them to try, you know, and hopefully I haven't scared them off the idea of bringing in good wild game to eat.
So what do you bring to your people there, Ryan?
Well, just, you know, whatever I've made, you know, like a
bite of something? Or
yeah,
some,
you know.
Pheasant or some...
Or sometimes, you know, like I'll make a whole bunch of something and, you know, there's only one of me. My wife really doesn't like the wild game side of stuff. And so I'll just bring in leftovers, and it's fun to be able to see the reactions and see, oh, man, that's actually quite good. You know, it's neat. I really like it.
Oh, that's great. Hey, we're going to go to a break. You're listening to Positively Healthy. We've got a lot of questions for all of the folks in the studio and for Hank Shaw. And we'll be right back after this. Do you have...
Move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just kicking down.
Okay, welcome back. Well, we want everybody feeling groovy, and part of that is eating real food, and the focus of this show is to get you making decisions that are easy, and they make sense to your brain, and one thing we do is we try to come up with ideas, and we have guests on that have, you know, a philosophy, something they're up to that has to do with something more natural, fewer chemicals, fewer processed foods, and our studio guest and our guest on the line is Hank Shaw. And Hank, welcome back. And in the studio we have Ryan Sablo and Mark Beecham. Welcome back, guys. And so, yeah. Well, hey, you know, I wanna compare and contrast a little bit your childhood with Ryan's here. And Ryan, what was it like for you growing up? Because you're one of these guys too.
Well, I'm not quite as good of a forager as Hank is.
But I know that you will be, I can tell.
Yeah, so a lot of the stuff that Hank does that I read about is fascinating stuff, and particularly like the ways that he goes out and will go out and find stuff that most of us would consider to be, you know, stuff that just you don't even notice, that stuff that's been cast aside by nature, like acorns, that kind of thing, that Hank sees as being, you know, the basis of lots of really good recipes, so I love it. But anyway, my background is I grew up in Siskiyou County. I'm a local kid, and my whole family more or less was from here. My grandfather on my mom's side is a logger. My dad's family, they came up from Sacramento area, but they've been in this area, in Northern California, for I think my Swiss grandparents came over in the early parts of the last century, and hunting and fishing is a big part of our family's what we do for fun. And it's traditionally, like my uncles and stuff are big, we're big bird and pheasant hunters, you know, duck and pheasant hunters. And on my mom's side, my grandpa was a logger, and so a lot of what, every year, I mean, a big part of what their table fare was deer that grandpa would get when he was out logging. And they weren't, on my mom's side in particular, weren't very wealthy, I mean, were quite poor. And so the wild game on their side of things really supplemented their diets.
Excellent.
And it wasn't, for me growing up, my dad had kind of, he kind of lost the drive to hunt when I was really little. But he still would take me out, and it was really only in the last few years when I was in, right after I graduated from college, that I kind of rediscovered how much I missed that, and I started going back out. And yeah, I've had some really, really nice experiences.
Ryan, what do you like about Hank Shaw's website, and what do you like about what he does?
I really like the way Hank makes... Wild game is really difficult to prepare if you don't know what you're doing, right? And Hank explains exactly how to do to prepare gourmet wild game in a way that it's easy to understand. And he has various recipes. What I like about it is I stick with most of his easy stuff. But he has, if you're a beginner trying to do it, he has some recipes. If you're kind of halfway between, he has some recipes. And then he's got a number of recipes where if you're a very skilled, you know, chef, you can make this stuff. And that's what I really like about it.
Hank, could you talk
a few recipes? It's funny you should say that, because there is a certain set of recipes I have on the site which are specifically written for the chef audience of the blog. And I was blown away a year ago when I was at a conference and a Michelin-starred chef from New York City walked up to me and said, "You're Hank Shaw? I love your website."
Oh, what a great...
Well, you're Brad Farmery. You have a Michelin star. it was just this crazy moment. And he's like, "Yeah, a lot of my buddies read your stuff, and it's really interesting what you're doing. Keep it up, da da da." So, you know, it gave me such inspiration to keep pushing the boundaries of what you can do with wild food. And every now and again, I'm working on two recipes that are almost entirely created of Northern California ingredients.
Wow!
Yeah, almost everything on the plate is from NorCal. And so,
like what? What's on the plate?
Really, kind of where the cutting edge is hyper local, hyper seasonal. No matter where you are, even if you're in a cold region, it becomes extremely difficult to do it if you're in, say, northern Minnesota. But it can be done, and that's what I'm trying to do now.
What kind of ingredients are you talking about when you're doing hyper Northern California? What?
Well, there's a dish I'm working on with pheasant. So it's hunted pheasant that I've cured with local dried mushrooms, ground to a powder, local California sages, you know, the wild sages, ground to a powder, and some salt. And then it's slow cooked in oil. It's confited, essentially. It's sort of, it's basically braising in oil until it just falls off the bone. And then I'm going to serve that with wild Sierra gooseberries. I made the gooseberries into a sauce. And I sort of go outside of California to make, I have some real, honest wild rice, not farmed wild rice.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got some wild gray pine nuts from just around this area. And the gray pine is that, it's sort of that's the one that a lot of us know is the digger pine.
Sure. But
apparently digger is a derogatory term, so... Yeah, I was like, "Oh yeah, it's a digger pine," until you talk to an Indian, and then like, "Oh yeah, you shouldn't use that word. So it's a gray pine."
We've learned that too.
Those are everywhere. And then I'm still tinkering with the dish, and I think I'm going to make a sauce out of the wild mustard that grows everywhere. You basically buzz the sauce, you basically blanch wild mustard to set the color, and then you buzz it in a food processor and push it through a sieve, so it forms a very smooth, vivid green sauce. And I think the combinations are going to work well together.
So Hank, I have a request for you, okay? Mm-hmm. Speaking of derogatory terms for things that we consider commonplace, it's like the Northern California pike minnow, which is commonly called the squawfish. You're supposed to technically not call it that, but Anyway, that's widely regarded as a trash fish, and I would love to see a recipe from you to make that into something nice.
That's easy, actually. I've caught a couple of pike minnows before, and as soon as I saw it, it reminded me of a combination of a freshwater drum and a red horse. And those are fish that live in the Midwest. And a freshwater drum looks like a... It's a relative of the California white sea bass. It's in the Kroeper family. But it's kind of oily, which is a good thing for what I want to do with it. And then when you cut these pike minnow up, they have an extra set of bones, like cod do.
Mm-hmm.
And that really puts a lot of people off because they're freaked out by that extra set of bones. Well, it's just another problem to solve. And the easiest way to do that is to smoke them.
Mm.
Oh.
So that oil keeps the meat nice and moist. So you take your pike minnow and you smoke it over, you know, hickory wood or almond wood is what I did because I live in an old almond orchard. And then you flake the meat off the bone so you don't have to worry about that extra set of bones. And then you make it into, you know, your regular, you know, mayonnaise and celery and whatever. And it's the greatest fish sandwich you have ever had.
Oh, my goodness.
I might take you up on that one.
That sounds great. Hey, Hank, we need to go to a break. But for any listeners who need your contact info that may need to go do something else right now, how do they find you? Can you give your website?
Well, you can find me either by Googling my name, which is Hank Shaw, or you can find my blog, which is Hunter, Angler, Gardener, Cook, or the website is honest-food.net.
Okay. Excellent. So we're going to take a quick break. Hank, don't go anywhere. You're listening to Positively Healthy. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt. We'll be right back.
Too tired.
All right, welcome back. Hey, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. And you're listening to Positively Healthy, and I understand that's Ted Nugent, and he's into hunting. So if that, if you can't draw that connection, hey, welcome back, Hank Shaw.
I'm still here.
Are you there? Good. All right. Hey, we have a question from Mark. Mark wanted to ask some questions.
Yeah, I understand you've won a lot of awards for your blog, including a James Beard Award, and you also have a book coming out, but before you talk about the book, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that a Michelin chef and other chefs read your blog and your other postings. Do you have a sense of who else reads your blog and keeps up on you, and what kind of numbers we're talking about?
I do have some sense, but let me correct you before I get started. I've been nominated for a James Beard Award twice. I've not yet won one, so... So far, I'm still the Susan Lucci of the James Beard Award.
That's cute.
I can sort of suss out my readership by who comments and where they come from, and it's an imprecise tool, but I do have a lot of, you know, what they call hook and bullet readers, which are, you know, actual hunters and anglers and foragers. That's a fair number, but I have probably the single largest piece of my audience are women. They are either the girlfriends or wives of hunters or anglers, or they're just food bloggers who are very, very interested in what I've been calling honest food, which is, you know, nothing that's packaged, you know, whole foods, things that are, you know, that your grandmother would recognize as food. And the best I can tell, about 60% of my readership are women, which I find really cool and very interesting. You know, numbers-wise, I get anywhere from, you know, 2,500 to 5,000 unique visitors a day, depending on the day. And, you know, it varies from time to time. I mean, in November, when there's hunting season, traffic spikes, and February tends to be a little down because everyone is coming off the hunting season and doing the honey-do list. So, but it ebbs and flows.
Are you able to make a kind of a part-time living with your website?
I am, and that's precisely how I'm doing it, a part-time living. I also earn some money. I do some catering here in Northern California, and I do freelance magazine writing. I just had a piece in Food and Wine, and then there's the book. And I also am a contributor for another website called Simply Recipes.
That's how I found you, yeah.
There you go. I mean, it's one of the biggest websites, food websites in the world. And the owner of it, Elise Bauer, she just lives down the road in Carmichael. And so she and I worked together to develop a different kind of recipes. I do, quite often, you still look at me and say, yeah, that's too esoteric. You put that on your site. And then, no, and then if it's a good home cooking, from scratch American food, then we work on it for her site.
So, Hank, one of the things I've always found interesting is with when I read your recipes, is you always try to throw in a little historical perspective as far as how did this particular recipe find its way to our tables here. Can you give us a little background? I know you've talked on your website quite a bit about how you are an aficionado for antiquated cookbooks.
Yeah.
Yeah, can you tell me a little bit about how you find these old cookbooks? What do you look for?
Sure.
Yeah, just tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, I went to graduate school for history, so I have a natural inclination for old books. And one of the things that I'm trying to do is, when you try to push the boundaries of any kind of thing, in this case wild food cooking, you see where people have gone before. And I have been continuously amazed at the sophistication and the level of skill of some of these very old cookbooks that will highlight an ingredient that no one ever uses anymore. I mean, acorn is a good example. In the various wild games. I mean, did you know that muskrat, of all things, used to be served at white linen restaurants in New York City?
I didn't.
It was a featured ingredient at Delmonico's 150 years ago.
Wow, that's cool.
And now it's considered trash, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, one easy way to do it is spend some time on a website called biblio.com. And Biblio is one of the great online repositories of used and rare books. And you can just spend hours on there leafing through what some bookstore in McLeod might have, and they put it on this database, and then you can buy it from them.
Oh, wow.
And I've spent a fair bit of change buying all those books. and it's just it's a wonderful wealth of information.
Now, how has people's perceptions of wild game changed over the years as far as flavors? I mean, particularly, like you mentioned, muskrat as being, a premier table fare at one point. What other types of animals that we now consider trash back when were extremely popular?
Turtles. Turtles is a big one. Beaver. Beaver was a big one as well. Then other things like plovers. Little plovers were considered sort of the pinnacle of game birds.
Yeah, but those are a shore bird, right?
Right. The only shore bird we can still hunt now are woodcock in the east and snipe in the west.
And people who don't know, when you talk about going snipe hunting, you can actually go snipe hunting. And like when I go duck hunting, I see snipe flying around all the time.
Wow.
You do indeed.
Hey, we're going to take another break, and when we come back, I want to talk about our wild boar, wild pig, wild hog, whatever they are out there running around in Shasta County and other counties, and sounds like we can eat them, and I'd like to learn more about that. So we're going to take a break. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt. You're listening to Positively Healthy here on KCNR 1460. Okay, welcome back. Hey, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to Positively Healthy. And in the studio, we have Ryan Sablow from the Record Searchlight, along with Mark Beecham from the Record Searchlight, and we have Hank Shaw calling in from the Sacramento area. And Hank, are you still there?
I am indeed.
Oh, okay. Well, you know what? We have, during the break, we're just going to kind of move our questions to you around a little bit. One question that's just plaguing everyone is that the gamey taste of some game. Why is it gamey, and what can you do about it?
And why is gamey
relative term?
Yeah.
Okay.
I prefer that my meat tastes like something.
Okay.
So if you have properly handled game, so in other words, if you've got a deer or ducks or whatever, and you don't let them heat up and you don't let them get funky when they are out in the field. So if you treat the meat has to get cold quick, and if you do that, then you really won't have a bad gamey taste. Now, what a lot of people associate with that is, wow, this tastes like something. Because most of our store-bought meats are fed corn. Corn doesn't taste like anything to us, because it's the baseline flavor. So if something doesn't taste like it's been corn-fed, it tastes weird to us. And some people associate that with a bad gamey flavor. I would associate that with a good wild flavor. And some people will brine their ducks. I never brine ducks, ever, because that takes a lot of the flavor out. And it's all sort of what you get used to. Now, if it's funky, sometimes you can control that and it's good. I mean, I will hang pheasants for 3 to 5 days before I even pluck them or gut them. Because I don't, a fresh pheasant tastes like a bad chicken. A pheasant that's been hung a few days tastes like something else. And I will freely admit it's not to everybody's liking, but nor is it bad tasting. It's strong tasting. And I think a lot of us are afraid of strong flavors.
Yeah, it's amazing that Hank will hang a pheasant for 3 to 5 days. There's some people who hang them for so long that they wait till the head pops off. And
that's a bit much even for me.
Yeah, that's kind of nasty.
So what flavor is coming through after 3 to 5 days, Hank, that makes it, what is it doing? What's happening?
Have you ever had dry-aged beef?
Yes.
It's the same thing. It's a to put it bluntly, it's a controlled rot.
Okay.
What you're doing is you are, the enzymes inside the bird, leaving the feathers on keeps the bird moist, because if you pluck the bird and hang it, then it's going to dry out and you're going to lose the skin.
But have you gutted it? Did you gut it?
No.
No.
Some people gut it, some people don't.
Okay.
I don't. If I were to hang it for 7 days, I might gut it. But what happens is the enzymes within the bird start to affect the meat, and they make everything a little softer, and they make everything a little bit more pungent in a good way. And it's enzymatic action breaking down the meat is sort of the science behind it.
Okay.
And it's one of the reasons why, like, if you kill a deer, traditionally you want to, or kill any game or any animal really, you want to hang it for a certain amount of time. That action of the bacteria getting in there and slowly breaking down the meat is what gives it, helps tenderize it and gives it flavor. And that's just, people don't really realize that that's what happens, but that's what's good.
Okay, and then as far as venison goes, so some venison, just I think of it as some of the best flavor I've had in my life, and then some is a little gamey. Now, is that because, by gamey for me, I mean like funky, like maybe, I don't know. I just didn't know if that was something the hunter did or that was something they were eating.
That's hard to say. Deer are pretty eclectic browsers. They can eat all kinds of different things. And I've had deer on the coastal range that were really sagey. And I've had deer in Wyoming that might as well have been beef. And so fat deeply affects, fat and diet affect flavor. So if you've got venison that's been, it's a bear hunting is a really great example. If you were to shoot a bear that's been eating salmon, God help you. But if you shoot a bear that's been eating huckleberries, you got yourself a treat. I mean, that's because all of that fishiness or all of that, sweet berry flavor is going to reside in the fat. And even though you can't see a lot of fat within the different muscle groups of a game animal, because very few game animals will store fat within the muscle. Like a marble piece of beef, that has intramuscular fat. You'll almost never see that in anything except a very, very fat wild boar.
Excellent. Okay, well, we have to take a quick break here. And before we go to that break, what's the name of your book again that's coming out soon?
The book is called Hunt, Gather, Cook, and it is coming out in May 26th.
May 26th. Around the corner. Okay, well, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to Positively Healthy. We'll be right back.
Too fast, slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last, just kicking down the cobblestones. Let
looking for fun and feeling groovy.
Welcome back. Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to Positively Healthy. On the line, we have Hank Shaw, author of Hunt, Gather, Cook. And in the studio, we have Ryan Sabolo of the Record Searchlight. And we have Mark Beecham from the Record Searchlight. And we are talking about hunting and cooking and foraging and all sorts of stuff. And Hank, welcome back.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, you know, in our area, and I don't know why so many people ask me this question, because I really don't know anything about it, but because I've been asked this so often, it's just piqued my curiosity. We have, in Shasta County and Tehama County, one county south, apparently a lot of wild boar. And I don't really know how they got here, and if it's, you know, if it's something going on all down the state. Is that something that's going on in your area, too?
Wild pigs have been in California for pushing 300 years.
Okay.
The Spaniards brought them here.
Spaniards.
And what ended up happening was they've mixed with hogs that have gotten loose. And there was also, at one point, I think they brought in some Eurasian boar for game stock. That also
they did. I think that was like Leland Stanford or Chester Crocker, one of those guys, back in the late 1800s.
And so you've started to get this mix of, when you're out hunting, sometimes you'll see hogs that look like they came right out of somebody's 4-H, out of someone's 4-H project.
Yeah.
Or else you'll sometimes see these ones.
Spotted ones.
Yeah. And then sometimes you'll see these ones that look like these giant Eurasian boars with big long snouts, and there's just kind of a mix. I mean, you'll see hogs that are half black, half pink running around, and it's kind of neat. And Hank, if you could tell us a little bit about, I know Trudy's really excited about this, ways in which you can prepare those hogs and kind of where they stack up versus other wild game as far as flavor, that kind of thing.
Pigs are like bears. They're super variable in flavor. I've had them anything from a little stanky to just as sweet and as wonderful as a heritage pig that you buy at the farmer's market. And generally speaking, if you catch them in late spring or in late fall, you're looking for them you're sort of tracking their diet. And when you hunt them when they are eating good stuff, they will taste wonderful. If you hunt them when they are eating bad stuff, they will not taste so good. And pigs can eat anything. So in the middle of high summer, their diet can be a little rough, and you might have to spice them a little harder. But right around about April, May is a prime time to hunt them. And September, October is another prime time to hunt them. Not a lot different from regular pork, except they're leaner.
Do they have a season? Do you need a license?
Yep.
What do you do here?
You do need a hunting license,
okay.
And you do need to buy a pig tag, which I think is what is it, Ryan? Is it $18 or something now?
I think they've gone up, but around here it's kind of difficult for the poor hunter to go hunt wild pigs unless you know somebody that has property. Or unless you want to pay a guide.
That's very true.
Because hogs live in, they don't live in the national forest generally. They are mostly lowland, oaks and rolling hills, typically the places that are owned by cattle ranchers. And cattle ranchers have found that they can also make some money, even though they hate the pigs because they go in there and tear up their fences and dig holes and eat a lot of forage for their cows, that people will pay, $700-$800 to go on a guided boar hunt. And so it's you either got to know somebody or you got to pay.
Okay. So this is not something that we can just sort of feed the poor or fill your freezer with great tasting pork.
Yeah,
for $18.
And it's quite involved. Hog hunting is they're primarily nocturnal animals, and you've got to get them, it's not like you're just going to walk out and shoot a hog in the middle of the afternoon. It's a pretty detailed process of how you got to go hunt them. Hank, could you talk to us a little bit about your book and what it's all about and why you felt that it was a worthwhile thing to try to do?
The book is an extension of the blog, and the book is really an extension of the single most common note, email, phone call, or whatever I get from readers, which is to say, I don't know how to do this. Can you help me get started in something? And so the whole point of the book is to offer something of a primer on foraging, on fishing, and on hunting for somebody who may not be an expert at all of those things. And I'm not an expert at all of them, but I'm pretty good at most of them, and where my knowledge has gaps, I've consulted experts who can help me out on it. So let's say you're a hunter, but you don't know much about foraging. That's where the first part of this book comes in. Let's say you're a forager but have never hunted before. That's where the third part of the book comes in. And let's say you're not real familiar with fishing. The book is separated into those sections because that's sort of the three main parts of wild food. The only thing I don't cover in this book is mushrooms, because mushrooms is a little bit more involved, and it would require a lot more background and tutorials before I want to let somebody out, picking mushrooms.
Can you tell us a little bit about your in-house photographer who takes all those lovely pictures on your website?
I can indeed. That is my girlfriend, Holly Heiser. And Holly is a great hunter in her own right, and she is she runs actually the hunting blog called NorCal Cazadora, and which is just Northern California Huntress in Spanish. And she is she's a professor at Sacramento State University, and she is probably a more avid duck hunter than I am.
She's a more avid duck hunter than I am, and that's saying something.
It's funny, I was just talking to her just the other day that she started hunting because I was gone all weekend and she wanted to spend time with me. This year, she was gone all the time in the marsh and I kind of wanted to spend time with her, so I hunted ducks a little bit more than I normally would.
And one thing, I know Hank's our guest, but if you have a lot of lady listeners, Trudy, and they're curious about women learning to hunt, her blog is really interesting, and it's really women-centric. And I love to read it because it's about, women trying to get into this sport and gear that they could find that fit them and ways to
try to stay warm.
Well, try to stay warm, yeah. And also how to size your shotgun and how to deal with what's traditionally been a very male dominated sport for a long time. It's really cool.
I think the overall goal between both of us is we want to get more people out into nature, whether it's foraging for wild plants or fishing lakes and streams in the ocean or hunting birds or hunting deer or hunting ducks. And people want a more tangible connection to their food, and they want to eat with a sense of place. And you really can't get any closer to that than by foraging or fishing or hunting. And the goal of the book is to help people make that happen.
Now, will you be teaching any classes to follow up with that? Are you going to help people with in any kind of seminars? Or
I am hoping to set up a few seminars once the book comes out. I'd love to do one in Reading.
Oh, good. You know people.
I do now.
Yeah.
And I'd like to do some cooking demos. And I'd kind of like my goal for when the book comes out is to do a little bit of a non-traditional book tour. Most people go to a bookstore and read from it, and then that's that. And I would much rather walk around with some people. I'd much rather show people how to cook things. I'd much rather, interact with people in what the book is all about.
Oh, that sounds great.
That sounds awesome.
Oh, I know. We're freaking out. Hey, we have to take another little commercial break, and don't go anywhere, Hank. And you're listening to Positively Healthy. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt. You're listening to KCNR 1460. We'll be right back. Aren't you always... Welcome back. Boy, are we feeling groovy. We're having a lot of fun here in the studio today. We have Ryan Sablow from the Record Searchlight, Mark Beecham, Record Searchlight, and we have on the line Hank Shaw calling in from the Sacramento area, and he is the author of Hunt, Gather, and Cook, and it's coming out May 26th, and that's his book that he's written, and he has done so much stuff. We are just taken. And so he has a fabulous website. And Hank, can you give folks your details again?
I can. It's my blog is called Hunter, Angler, Gardener, Cook, And the website is honest-food.net. And you can just find it by Googling my name, which is Hank Shaw. I'm number one on that result, so you can find me pretty easy on the Internet.
Excellent. Okay.
Hank, I wanted to ask you, go back to something you said about the antique cookbooks. And you were surprised at the sophistication of some of these recipes that you ran across. And, you know, the sort of stereotypical image of somebody cooking around 1890 or whatever is like flapjacks over a campfire. But, in fact, even though people were using wood stoves, they were very sophisticated in the way they prepared foods and the different sauces they made and the preparation. What was the menu or menus that surprised you the most?
It's really not so much the menus that surprised me, because this is 120, 130 years ago, they still had market hunting, and this was in the middle of the Gilded Age, so you had unparalleled wealth. What surprised me most was the ingredients, that a typical white table, you know, tuxedo-wearing banquet menu would include things like turtle soup, would include things like canvasback ducks and venison from the Adirondacks, and, you know, a whole course of little birds like, you know, plovers or woodcock or snipe. And, you know, the diversity of what they all ate was really, really, truly remarkable. I mean, if you think about what you and what most people eat, what really anybody but freaks like me do, is you eat pork, you eat beef, you eat salmon, you eat chicken, and you eat turkey twice a year, and call it a day. And the diversity of proteins that people ate in an earlier age is really kind of remarkable to me.
I wanted to ask you, we don't have much time left, but one of the things that's fascinating to me is the way that you use acorns to make things like pasta. Can you give us just a little rundown of the best time of year to go get acorns, like where you look, and, you know, some of the things you could do with it?
Ooh, that's a long topic.
We have one minute.
Okay, you want to get them in September or October. You want to get the ones that don't have little holes in them. The little holes are weevils. Those are bad. You want to grind them up with some water in a blender. Then you want to soak. You know, you've got to change the water in the refrigerator, you know, maybe 6-7 days to get all the bitter tannins out. You can't eat acorns that have not had those tannins taken out. Then when you get that, it's sort of it'll be a bland-tasting mush. Then you dry it out in a warm oven or a dehydrator, and then you've got flour. And you can use that as a substitute or to add flavor to anything that you would normally bake or use flour for. It does not have gluten, so it will not rise like wheat flour. And it doesn't stick to itself as well as wheat flour, but it has a lot of flavor. It's free, and the actual leaching process, which is taking the bitter tannins out, is pretty low labor intensive. It takes a while, but you don't do too much. I have full tutorials on all kinds of acorn stuff on my website, so if you're actually interested in it, you can find any information you want to find out, both from the book, because there's a huge chapter on acorns in the book, and also on the site. So I use it as, I just made cookies with it. I used it for a little bit of the flour, and I made a pine nut and acorn flour cookie.
Interesting.
It was really delicious. I mean, it's sort of an experiment that worked.
Oh, gosh, love it. Hey, Hank, I want to thank you for coming on today. We're out of time now, and we just loved having you. We learned so much, and I'm looking at the two other co-hosts, and they were having a lovely time also. Ryan, thank you for coming on.
You're
Mark,
welcome.
Thank you for coming on. Jim Bremer, thanks for being here today. You've been listening to Positively Healthy. Next week, we're having someone on to talk about food addiction, so make sure you're here. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week.